The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black.
Our guest on this episode is Lacey Crawford, author of the new book, Notes on a Silencing, a memoir, which is one of the most anticipated books of the year. It's the story of Lacey's sexual assault as a teenager by two fellow students at the elite St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire, which is one of the top boarding schools in the country.
The Washington Post calls the book a haunting exploration of the systemic ways assault victims are ignored. Lacey, we thank you so very much for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
How would you describe what happened that night back in October of 1990? Because I know you write that you had trouble even coming up with a word or a phrase to describe what happened.
Oh, sure. I didn't have any words for what had happened to me the moment I was able to leave their room. I mean, the details are pretty widely distributed in media now. People can, you know, click and find out what it was that happened. But I think it was actually a very ordinary assault. I was a 15-year-old girl. I received a phone call on the payphone in my boarding school dorm. This was long before cell phones, from a student who was a senior. He was a very popular, prominent athlete who had a long-term girlfriend. They were one of those couples that, as a younger student, you sort of gazed at when they walked down the hall. You know, they would move sort of like sharks, and all the other fish would, you know, give them some space and then form up again behind them, you know. And I didn't understand why he was calling me. I was flattered, but obviously it had nothing to do with, you know, romance. Not that that's where that was headed, but he sounded like he's crying, and he asked for my help. And I was young enough and naive enough and sort of teenage enough to think, oh, I must have something I can really help him with. Yeah. And he asked me to sneak out of my dorm and cruise was the verb we used, cruise across campus after check-in, which is the time when all students had to be back in their dorms for the night. He asked me to sneak out. This was a huge no-no, an immediate disciplinary intervention. If you get caught, there were security guards who roamed the campus all night long looking for us. It was a kind of cat and mouse game. And I'd never done it before, of course. I was a very good girl. But I did, because he sounded like he was crying. He said it had something to do with his mom. I didn't know. And I was pretty sure I was growing up fast and had a lot to offer the world. And I was going to start by helping this poor, you know, football star. And so I snuck across campus and had sneakers and blue jeans and a parka, a pullover. And he pulled me up into his window. And his roommate was there, and I didn't know who his roommate was, really. The lights were off. They didn't have clothes on. And I said, so what's wrong? And they said, shh, you know, and made it immediately clear that their wall, they shared a wall with the dorm head who had an apartment in that dorm who was a teacher. And if he had heard me, he would have come in and flipped on the lights because there were no locks on our student doors. And he would have seen me on a bed, because there was a bed beneath the window. So they pulled me onto a bed, on a bed with two undressed seniors after hours. And there would be no way out of that. It was an instant suspension for sure. And God, I would have had to call my parents and they would have had to flow me home. And there goes my academic record, you know, with regard to college applications. And I was terrified. And so I said, what, you know, what is it? What happened? And then they pushed me down and began to touch my body in ways that made it immediately clear that this was an entirely different genre of moment than what I had been anticipating.
Right.
I was in a YA romance, a middle grade romance, right? Mm-hmm. And now I was in a very violent moment, and I didn't know what that was or what to do about it. And so I said, I was a virgin, and I said, just don't have sex with me. Because I knew that there were very real worries about getting pregnant or getting HIV/AIDS. I had been taught these things, certainly in health class. And I thought I would be okay, right? If they didn't have sex with me, that I would be okay. It didn't occur to me what else they could do. Well, they had some ideas. Mm-hmm. So they penetrated me orally, one at a time, and they sort of held me so the other one could access me the way he wanted to. And then at the end, you know, they said, it's your turn now, which I didn't, those words went into my head and lodged there, but I didn't even begin to try to think what that meant, you know, for a long time. And they let me go. And so there I was back outside the room on the sandy path at night in sneakers and jeans and a pullover and a parka, a changed person. And I think, you know, it's horrible, but it's also really, really ordinary and happens to so many of us. So I didn't write this book because I thought there was anything particularly interesting or useful, even by recounting the particulars of the assault. It was the particulars of what followed that strike me as possibly useful.
And, you know, as I've gotten older, I've had quite a few friends who've come forward to me and say that they had somewhat similar experiences and that they didn't really go into a situation with a guy where they were expecting something physical to happen to the extent that it did. And they felt kind of manipulated, or they just didn't feel they were ready for something. And my heart goes out to every girl who feels like that, because I think as young girls, we don't know what to do, and we don't know what to expect. So we don't know what's okay. And we don't know really not so what's not okay. Why is it that girls like you and girls like my friends struggle so much to put the guy at fault and to really label what has happened to them as assault rather than, oh, you know, he was messing around, or, oh, I let it get too far.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was my fault.
Oh, because society doesn't, right? I mean, it's this extraordinary paradox that, and I know things are changing and continue to change, and I want to be mindful of that, but men still dominate in positions of power across almost all sectors of American society, right? And global society. And yet at the same time, when it comes to the question of assault, and particularly sexual assault, we assign all the agency to the girl or the woman. You know, it's like he's suddenly somehow powerless, and it's just that she was in a short skirt, or it's just that, you know, she didn't actually bite him, so he didn't know, you know, that she wasn't, you know, she said no, but she didn't try to kill him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she must have been okay with it, really. And this is a marvel to me, because very simply and almost even crudely, one of these men, again, they were 18, I was 15, you know, I'd had my period for like 9 months. I mean, I was still trying to figure out, you know, everything about how bodies work. One of them was almost a foot taller than I was. He was an extraordinarily talented athlete. I mean, just physically huge. So the thought that somehow I did this is baffling to me. And I feel that way about every single instance where we turn around and we sort of say, well, you know, she shouldn't have been there, she shouldn't have said it that way, or she shouldn't have whatever it is. And I know that there are so many complicated ways that we have internalized what to me is pretty clear misogyny, the sense that we need to take care of ourselves because we might otherwise tempt a man into being aggressive or violent, in which case it will be our fault. I certainly had that drilled into me in whatever silent ways, such that the minute I left that room, the one thing I knew for sure is that I had got it completely wrong and that nobody must ever know what had just happened.
We thank you for being part of our Nobody Told Me family of listeners. Our conversation continues as we tell you more about our sponsor, Green Chef, and a special offer Green Chef has just for our listeners.
Green Chef is a CCOF certified meal kit company that makes eating well easy with plans to fit every lifestyle. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free, or just looking to eat more balanced meals, Green Chef offers a range of recipes to suit your preferences.
Fill up with protein packed. That's Green Chef's newest collection of recipes fit for a high-protein dietary preference. Choose from 3 weekly menu items, each including at least 40 grams of protein per serving. You can expect a variety of satisfying and flavorful recipes, like Greek chicken salad with mint olive tapenade, enchilada spiced turkey bowls, and almond-crusted barramundi.
Celebrate springtime with recipes featuring premium proteins, seasonal organic produce, and sustainably sourced seafood. This month, I'm loving Green Chef's savory seared beef tenderloin with shiitake mushrooms and green beans and a spicy ginger lime aioli.
As for me, my favorite this month is Green Chef's chicken with garlic charred rice with a delicious apricot pan sauce and roasted almonds.
And Green Chef is the only meal kit that is both carbon and plastic offset. They offset 100% of their delivery emissions to your door, as well as 100% of the plastic in every box. Plus, nearly all packaging materials are curbside recyclables in most areas in the U.S.
Make time for exciting plans and new goals this spring with Green Chef's convenient, wholesome recipes featuring seasonal organic produce and unique farm fresh ingredients like rainbow carrots, bok choy, and olives.
Plus, you'll cut down on meal prep with pre-portioned and prepped ingredients, including pre-measured sauces, spices, and dressings.
And now here's the special offer for Nobody Told Me listeners. Just go to greenchef.com/nobody60 and use code nobody60 to get 60% off plus free shipping.
Green Chef is the number one meal kit for eating well.
Just go to greenchef.com/nobody60 and use code nobody60 to get 60% off plus free shipping.
So tell us what happened then in the aftermath of that. You walk away obviously traumatized and thinking, I can't let anyone ever know about this. Tell us more about the physical and emotional effects that you experienced.
Well, so they told a lot of people what had happened in that room. This was another thing I wasn't anticipating. So that the next day, there were certain teammates of theirs who were sort of looking at me differently. And then they started hissing things to me. You know, somebody after seated meal, which was our sort of fancy dinner, said threesome. And I don't know that I even knew that word, or maybe I had heard it, you know, in sort of boys' playful banter, but I had no idea what that actually would have looked like or why or who or when or how. And I thought, my God, you know, this is now an entity that is out in the world, and it's out in the world beyond them, these two boys. And when I say this, what I mean is this horrible, violating thing, which had touched some core part of me in a way that felt extraordinarily private, was now a piece of public property, effectively. It was a bit of high school gossip. And it was, to be blunt, really good high school gossip, because I hadn't had a serious boyfriend, and I was in a bunch of choirs, and I did have a lot of freckles and a little red ponytail, and I was very earnest and probably maybe a little bit annoying. I mean, you know, I had good friends, but this was kind of not in keeping with my general persona, that I would cruise, you know, to these boys' room in the middle of the night and, you know, get them off. And that was the story that they told. So I denied it. I denied it by saying nothing. I denied it when friends asked, did something happen? I simply couldn't talk about it. What did start to happen is I got sick. My throat hurt, and then it hurt really badly. And I went to the infirmary. I couldn't see that there was anything wrong with me, but it was getting hard to swallow. And I went to the infirmary, and the nurse, you know, took the tongue depressor. And I said, and she said, you know, there's nothing there. You don't have strep. Everything's fine. You know, just get some sleep. So I figured I was just being punished for what had happened to me. It was a kind of melodramatic teenage girl explanation, really, for this thing that I could not understand and couldn't contain, really, the size of it. And my throat got worse, and I started losing weight because I was unable to eat. And then I would taste blood in the morning when I woke up. And so I was sent to a specialist off campus who was in downtown Concord, New Hampshire. And that was an ear, nose, and throat specialist who was able to use appropriate tools. They numb up your throat. They actually have you gargle viscous lidocaine. So the same stuff that's used, like if you get stitches that they inject, is you gargle it and it kind of numbs your throat after a while. And then they can get past the gag reflex and look down your throat. And in that way, it was discovered that I had big herpetic lesions. I had contracted herpes very deep in my throat. But somehow that information was not given to me. So this is about 2 weeks after the assault. It's late October of my junior year in high school. I'm 15 years old. My mom is trying to fly me home to Chicago because I'm so sick and I'm in the infirmary and I can't eat. And the doctors know what's wrong with me, or at least have a strong enough suspicion to write it down in medical records that I later saw. But they didn't tell me. So my pediatricians at home thought I had lupus. They thought I had a whole host of very scary autoimmune disorders that can cause sort of sloughing, you know, and mucous membranes. But of course, it was only one place. It was pretty clear what was happening. So I was very sick. I remained very sick for many months, and I wouldn't have been. Otherwise, I would have been treated, and I wasn't. And I finally told my mom what had happened in May, so it was not 6 months later. I have medical records now that I accessed a couple of years ago as part of this state investigation into my school from my pediatrician at home in Chicago. And these detail how the pediatrician, several of them, were working together to try to figure out what was wrong with me. They were communicating with a doctor at St. Paul's School, and they were worried that I had lupus or any of a number of other autoimmune disorders that could cause sort of lesions and mucous membranes. But none of these diagnoses fit me. And the reason they didn't fit me is because it's not what I had. And St. Paul's, for whatever reason, chose not to communicate to my doctors at home or to my parents or to me what I had. So I remained sick for many months and had a very, very hard time for the rest of that year. I finally told my mom what had happened on the very same payphone that they had called me on. I called her and she flew me home and took me immediately to my pediatrician at home, who swabbed my throat and sent it off for proper testing. And we got a proper diagnosis, and she took my case history and she said, "I'm very sorry, but I'm going to have to report this to the state of New Hampshire." You know, she was a mandated reporter, and this was a felonious sexual assault. That was what kicked off the official response to my assault. But by that point, the school, which had already been told by my parents why they were flying their daughter home, had begun their own internal investigation. And those two investigations, one of which is in quotation marks for me, really form sort of twin stories in the book.
Please talk to us about that second trauma that you experienced, which was just everything that happened to you with the criminal justice system. Once it became apparent to you that school leadership did know about you, and there was this big cover up to try and make it so nobody else found out.
Yeah, so that happened in 2017. So I went through this when I was 15, 16 years old. My poor parents were shattered. It was devastating. This was 30 years before Me Too. I don't think that communities had the tools or the vocabulary to talk about things, you know, that we do have now. I think there is great progress in that way. The fact that you and I are even having this conversation right now, you know, represents to me progress, at least given the community I grew up in. So I sort of muddled through and put this behind me to the extent to which somebody can. And I had sort of stopped talking about it and was, you know, in my early 40s and living here in California with my husband, who of course knows all about this, but it's not an active part of our lives and our children. And there was another girl who was sexually assaulted at St. Paul's School. She was 15 years old and a freshman, Chessie Prout. And she immediately told, she told within 20 minutes what had happened to her, and the police investigation and the trial that followed made national headlines. And the boy who assaulted her was convicted on multiple charges and lost his admission to Harvard and did spend some time in jail. And I didn't really want to watch this much, but I had I heard from a friend that, and this may be too long-winded an answer, but I heard from a friend that the school had done a rather remarkable thing. And that is this: in investigations of sexual assault, the names of minors, if they are victims, are by almost universal precedent withheld. We don't give the name of a minor victim of a sexual assault. These
right.
things are you know, redacted in mm-hmm. legal filings and other paperwork. The media does not report them. And that's an important measure of respect and protection for a girl. In this case, St. Paul's School petitioned the Superior Court in Merrimack County to release Chessie Prout's name, because they didn't think it was fair that the media should be blowing up about St. Paul's, but not the girl. And a friend of mine, an old friend who is a lawyer, said, "I can't believe this. I've never seen anything this nasty." And she actually pulled the filing down off the court website and sent it to me. And the experience I had seeing that turned a key in me, because that is almost exactly analogous to what they did to me. They publicly shamed me. They slandered me to keep me from pressing charges against the boys, because it would have been a real black mark on their reputation. And they were doing it now. They were doing it 25 years later. Now, what Chessie Prout did is she outmaneuvered them. And she went on the Today Show and she outed herself as someone who is articulate and unashamed. And she, in order to do that, had to transform her life, right, to become a victim advocate. She was no longer a high school girl for a while there. And the cost of that is extraordinary. And it frightened me. And so I would not still have come forward had it not been that, as a result of the Prout case and others, the state of New Hampshire opened a formal investigation into St. Paul's, into whether it had failed to protect children in its care, whether it had failed to report assaults that took place on its campus. And I thought, you know, I know a little something about that.
Yeah.
Right. So I privately got in touch with the Attorney General's office. Only my husband knew. I was interviewed again by detectives of the Concord Police Department, who are wonderful. My parents were interviewed, teachers from that time, you know, all the corroborating sort of chronological evidence that they were recreating from my case file in 1990-91. And somehow the school found out that I was participating in this investigation, and I got an email from their lawyers asking me to contact them at my earliest convenience. And I thought, you know, what is this? And forwarded it to the police. And the police said, all right, we got to act fast, and went and got a hold of my student file from 1992. And in my student file was documented evidence of the way the school basically planned to make the problem of my assault, by which they meant the problem of me, go away. It was there. It was written down. It was in a lawyer's hand. And the police said, we got it. We got it. This is the smoking gun. This is what the state investigation is looking for. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I was right. I'm going to be vindicated. My parents, my poor parents, will be vindicated. We were right. And they did do this. And we always knew, but we couldn't even let ourselves believe that it was true. And then the Concord Police Department was severed from my case. The state investigators refused to include my file or anything from it in their investigation into St. Paul's School. And when I found out about that from Concord Police, I thought I would lose my mind. So I had a few options, and one of them was tell the story myself.
Right,
tell it true, tell the whole thing, you know, which is kind of, if you don't listen to a girl when she's 15, watch out, because you're going to get a 357 page book, you know, in 30 years. Right? So it's up to you. You know, I would listen when she was 15. And that's how we're here. So again, you know, I didn't really know what had been done, or I should say I knew what had been done, but I did not trust my own experience of what had been done to me enough to grant me the authority to be as angry, as properly angry as I was when I finally figured it out. And I benefited too from the fact that I was an adult and I have children and I know how young 15 is now. I thought I was very, very grown up when I was 15.
You know? You always do at 15.
Yeah. Oh, I was almost done growing up at 15 for sure. But now I see 15-year-olds and I don't want them anywhere near cars. I'm not even sure I want them on bicycles. Like, I, you know, I'm like, these are very young people.
Yeah.
And so I was able to access not only the authority that came from seeing the evidence, but also some compassion that comes from being old enough to realize that I was a child. I was a girl.
Would it have been an option for you to pursue criminal charges against these boys as an adult?
Yes, it was offered to me. There are some complex reasons why the statute of limitations did not apply in my case that really just have to do with luck and circumstance. And I chose not to, very deliberately. That to me, and it's just me, every survivor is different. For me, that did not feel like it would offer me a remedy. It felt like it would take me further away from my life. So I would have had to physically fly to New Hampshire, you know, for a long period of time to be present at trial. I had a two-year-old. I'm not going to kiss my two-year-old goodbye and stay in a, you know, motel in Concord. Why?
Yeah.
Right? You know, to be cross-examined by a defense attorney who's going to do his job and try to convince me that I was XYZ. No, there's nothing I want from these boys. And there's nothing I want for them other than kindness for them and for the people in their lives. So, that's not being sort of Zen-like. You know, I'm not sure that comes from a place of generosity. I think it comes from a very clear logistical understanding that I have lost so much to them and I don't want to lose one more thing.
And what has happened to them in the aftermath?
This is awful. I don't know much. I don't Google them or follow them on social media. I don't lurk. I don't care really. But one of them has been tangled up with the criminal justice system for the better part of 30 years, was arrested for the first time 6 months after he graduated from our high school, has served time in jail, has struggled. And to that, I say the school failed, not just me, when they refused to intervene, because I do think that at least in his case, he felt a lot of shame. And I think the violence that I experienced was him trying to get me to carry that for him. I often think that's a way to try to think about sexual assault. It's reductive, but to me, it's helpful. I was scapegoated in a way. I'm gonna carry the shame. I'm going to carry the wounding, and they are going to be big and strong and untouchable. And obviously he didn't feel so big and strong and untouchable because he wasn't able to put together the life that his education at this high school would have suggested awaited.
Right. And it's too bad as well, because we've heard from so many experts on this show that that kind of violence escalates over the years. So it's too bad they weren't able to provide him with that kind of help, you know, at that age.
And what happened to the other one?
So this is more remarkable. And let me say one thing. When detectives offered me the chance to press charges, they did say that neither man had another sexual assault charge on his record. And because I asked that, you know, we talked about that. Would it protect other women or girls? Is there someone else out there, you know, whose life will be immeasurably improved by knowing that she's not the only one, you know, that this guy got, right? And they said, well, look at how difficult it is to bring charges even in your case. You know, we have a documented statutory assault and there's nothing on their record about it. So these things are so complicated and so difficult. But I still made the choice that I made. I have, since the excerpt of my book was published in Vanity Fair, I have had 3 people reach out to me directly with experiences of violence and or violation at the hands of this other man.
Oh, wow.
That they have never reported. They have now actually reported that to the police. And to me, I would never want somebody else to be in pain, but there is no substitute for that kind of solidarity. There's just none.
Yeah, and women spend so much of their lives trying to get past attempts like these and horrible, horrible assaults like these, and they kind of never can get over them. And I want to preface this next question by saying that as a sexual assault survivor myself, I understand that there really is no such thing as closure, and you learn to deal with what's happened to you and come up with strategies and find a support system. And, you know, you in some ways, I think that You get to be more grateful for your circumstances some days, and then other days you have tough days. But anyway, in your case, have you found that you felt closure? Has the book given you closure, or has just living your life and having a family given you any closure?
You said it, right? I mean, it's undigestible in a way, you know, the experience of this, and it's particularly the way the community related to me after this happened, the way I was let down by faculty and priests and administrators, that shaped how I understood myself and my relationship to the world in ways that I think it will take me a very long time to understand and to undo. I think just the lack of self-esteem, the shame, it does color how you experience things. And that's a great loss. And that is something that I almost have to sort of practice undoing, if that makes sense, just on a daily basis. I have been so blessed or lucky, pick your word, that I have a partner who is both familiar with violence from his own life and family's experience and really unimpressed by it, if that makes sense. So it's not something that needs to be active between us. It's not, you know, it's not alive in our marriage, except in as much as we hold each other through the things that hurt and the things that are wonderful. So there has been enormous sort of closure in that I have arrived in this safe place. And yes, since this story has started going into the world, the notes, the flood of notes that I have received, it is me too, it is my daughter too, my son too, or it wasn't even sexual assault, horrible hazing, or just a sense of betrayal, a sense of grief, a sense of loss from other students, young people who now are 40, 50, 60, 70 years old in some case, who are finding each other. Actually, they're connecting with each other, and they've written me to say, I've reconnected with these people because we want this to change, and I'm so grateful. I had packed this away for so long. So that kind of makes me feel a bit like I'm carrying a burning torch, and you know, I'm pushing ahead in this dark field where I have been for a very long time. And you know, I think high school is such a claustrophobic experience in the best of circumstances, because adolescence is this hothouse, and we are both so self-involved and so desperately need each other, you know, in that moment. And so to have all of these people who were figures from that time in my life reemerge as adults, writing these really lovely and thoughtful and articulate and powerful notes of support and offering their own stories, that to me is breathtaking. And I would be sad, you know, not to have had this happen, which I suppose is a kind of closure, right? Because it means that I've accepted the antecedent to it.
Lacey, you know, our show is called Nobody Told Me, and we always ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? And I'm sure that there are probably a lot of ways that you could answer this question, but what is it that nobody told you about being a victim, about not speaking up, about feeling that you were being silenced, about, you know, moving on, about attempting to get some kind of closure? What would you say is your Nobody Told Me lesson?
I'm not sure it would have been enough without knowing, you know, what I know now about the system that I was a part of. But I needed to hear and believe that I was a reliable witness to my own experience, such that
No, that's really deep. I think that's something so many sexual assault survivors need to hear. That's fascinating.
When they pushed you down, Lacey, you're right. That's violent and not okay. There, you know, I tried to make it all make sense. I tried to make it all make sense instead of saying, you've got to be kidding me. This is not how this goes, you know, and I don't care if I get caught, and I don't care if the lights go on, and I don't care about college, and I don't care. And again, it wouldn't have been enough to just say that, because I did care about all of those things very much. Of course I did. But thereafter, if I had been able to say, wow, that was a violent assault on your body and your sense of self, we're going to go find someone, and we're going to keep knocking on doors until somebody hears us the way we need to be heard. If I had known that, everything from that day forward, I think would have had a kind of ballast to it that it took me another 15, 20 years to find.
And Lacey, as we mentioned, the new book, Notes on a Silencing, a Memoir, is one of the most anticipated books of the year. So can you tell our audience where they can learn more about that and connect with you on social media?
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter. That's my most active social media. And it's Lacey, L-A-C-Y underscore Crawford at Twitter. Do you want actual handles? Is this useful?
Yes. Sure. And your website as well.
And my website, exactly, which is just Lacey Crawford, LACYCrawford.com. I'm specifying the spelling of my first name because there are like 17 Lacey Crawfords and several of them are very kindly annoyed that they're getting the messages they're getting. Anyway, so at my website, and you can also email me through my website. And I am on Instagram, but I'm not very good at it. And I'm terrible on Facebook. So I am very much available through my website and through Twitter. And those would be the best ways to track me down.
Well, Lacey, we thank you so very much for sharing this story with us. I mean, it's heartbreaking. And yet there are some encouraging notes, you know, in it as well. I mean, to see how you've come through on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think everybody can really appreciate your bravery in coming forward, because I think the more women continue to say, you know what, this happened to me and I'm strong and it ended up being okay and it's not your fault, I think that's the only way we're all going to heal. So we really appreciate you being a part of that.
I mean, we do come through, don't we?
Yeah.
We do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our thanks again to Lacey Crawford. And again, her book is called Notes on a Silencing. Her website is LaceyCrawford.com. And again, that's Lacey, L-A-C-Y, Crawford.com. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.